Job one, blame the union.
It's just easy to take the union and blame us for everything. It's the fault of the UAW. All they want to do is say, wait a minute, workers shouldn't have a voice in their workplace.
USA in your Chevrolet, America is asking you to call.
The Obama administration is asking the UAW to go back to the drawing board to save General Motors. With Rick Wagoner out, the UAW is in the bullseye.
So make a date today to see the USA. See it in your Chevrolet.
Act now. These prices won't last on The Takeaway.
Traveling west, wherever you go.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, March 31st. Adora Udoji is away spending time with her new baby. And coming up this hour, we'll hear what some UAW autoworkers think of the president's plan for the industry. Travel writer Pico Iyer talks with us about the Dalai Lama's shifting global presence. And we go to Rome for a closer look at Chrysler's possible new arranged marriage with Fiat. Those stories and more coming up, but first the top headlines. Barack Obama heading to London this morning to attend the G20 summit on Thursday. He's also set to meet with leaders of Britain, Russia, and China and visit four countries, including Turkey. Meanwhile, in Detroit, auto workers are reacting to the president's tough new terms for GM and Chrysler. DeJuan Williams works at GM. He says he's angry, but he gets it.
Of course, we don't want to take a pay cut, but if it deals with keeping jobs, we have to do what we have to do.
GM's new head, Fritz Henderson, says a strategic bankruptcy with government backing is perhaps less risky than Chapter 11. They have 60 days to come up with a Plan A, Plan D, Plan Z.
We need to take tougher measures to make sure that GM can sustain itself in this kind of environment, one. Two, that we do this once so that we're not being required to go back to the taxpayer on a continuous basis. And third, that we can pay the taxpayer back.
And fourth, that Henderson keeps his job. Mark Garrison, what else is going on?
Good morning, John. Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius goes before the Senate's Health Committee today. It's the first of two Senate appearances for the president's second Health and Human Services Secretary nominee. She goes before the Senate Finance Committee on Thursday. There are warnings this morning to avoid pistachios, both the nuts and any foods containing them. This after word of a possible salmonella outbreak. It's early in the federal investigation into that. A California-based processor is voluntarily recalling 2 million pounds of pistachios.
Peanuts, pistachios, they should just change the FDA to the FNA, the Food and Nut
Administration.
Yeah,
yeah. That's right. Over in Fargo, North Dakota, residents are still worried about the Red River, but they're currently waiting out a blizzard. The snow is not the threat as much as the 30 to 40 mile an hour winds that could stress the levees. In Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu will be sworn in as prime minister for a second time. He held the post in the late 90s. Also, just a quick update on the Khmer Rouge war crimes trial we talked about yesterday. The prison chief, known as Comrade Duyk, apologized today, accepting responsibility for the deaths of more than 14,000.
Incredible. Asian markets mixed today. Europe is rallying. The Dow is expected to bounce upward when Wall Street opens in about an hour and a half. We can't let the auto industry vanish, but we do need a new slogan.
Hello, this is Aaron from Norwalk, Connecticut, and my new slogan for the automotive industry is like a rock. Dropping on your foot.
Oh, like a rock. Ow! Ow! Your slogan at 877-8MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Right on schedule yesterday, Barack Obama stepped to the podium and outlined a stern response to GM and Chrysler's plans to restructure. More restructuring is necessary, says the president, and GM has 60 days to do it, while Chrysler has only 30 days to make a deal with Italian automaker Fiat. So Rick Wagoner, the government no longer has him as CEO of General Motors to push around anymore, but it looks like the UAW, the United Auto Workers Union, is on deck. And the question is, how many more sacrifices will be asked of workers on the line? Workers all over the United States in the auto industry are mulling over the details of the Barack Obama speech and what's likely to shake out over the next few weeks. Joining us now is our friend Will Markham, a UAW worker in Pontiac. Will, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you.
And Terry Harden joins us. He's been a UAW worker for 31 and a half years. He's at GM's Assembly Center in Pontiac along with Will. Terry, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, John. It's good to be with you.
So I'm going to play something which I'm sure you heard yesterday from Barack Obama speaking directly to auto workers such as yourselves. And then just let me know how you felt when you heard the president say this.
Many of you have been going through tough times for longer than you care to remember. And I won't pretend that the tough times are over. I can't promise you there isn't more difficulty to come. But what I can promise you is this. I will fight for you. You're the reason I'm here today. I got my start fighting for working families in the shadows of a shuttered steel plant. I wake up every single day asking myself, what can I do to give you and working people all across this country a fair shot at the American dream?
So, Will and Terry, I'll begin with you. You know, it's all about a confidence in this economy. Did the president give you confidence yesterday?
Well, I wouldn't say he gave me quite confidence, although I'm more than happy to, you know, that he says he's going to step in and give us some assistance. I'm just kind of concerned about what conditions are going to be, you know, have to be met for that assistance.
As a worker in the plant, do you feel vulnerable at this point that the restructuring could go on and that you're not going to have much of a say in how things look 60 days from now?
Oh, you're absolutely correct. With 31 and a half years seniority, I feel that I really have no more sense of security than when I started over 30 years ago. I mean, it's pretty scary.
And Will, how about you?
Oh, I feel the same way. I'm sitting with 25 years seniority, you know what I mean, with no options whatsoever. We've been pretty much in the dark throughout this whole process, and I can honestly say today we're just as confused about what's going on when you and I first started talking back in November.
Has the union leadership been in touch with you, emailing, giving you a sense of where we go from here? Either one of you will?
Well, I've seen some information, and, you know, we know about where we're being planned. Of course, you know, we can't negotiate in the public. You know, that's against the NLRB. So, but we do know that we have quite a bit on the table already that I don't think most people know about, and it's just scary how much further they want us to go.
Now, Terry, this morning, you know, it occurred to me, do you wish you were working over at Ford this morning?
You know, I've been pretty fortunate in my career at GM, but, you know, to be totally honest with you, I have had thoughts where, you know what, maybe it wouldn't be so bad to be with Ford because they're certainly seem to be in a better position than us, stating that they're not going to take any government loans because then they don't have to answer and I guess, you know, dance to their beat.
Now, Terry and Will, what are they doing over there that's different? I mean, you talk to UAW workers that are on the line at Ford plants around the country. Terry, you first.
You know, it's really hard to say. You know, I don't know. Maybe their leadership might be, you know, a little better. I mean, I just have some concerns with our leadership. You know, their compensation packages of Mr. Wagner. You know, he's looking at $20 million retirement, and we're looking at a possible quick rinse bankruptcy, which would cut our retirement in half. I mean, I don't know that people really understand that, you know, that he's going to be fine, and we're over here, you know, we're struggling.
No, I think a lot of people do understand that, but, you know, you reiterate, you state it very, very well. You know, one of the things that Barack Obama presented yesterday, I want you to react to, Will, is the idea that maybe using the tax code, we can re-stimulate demand for GM and Chrysler cars. Listen to this.
The IRS is launching a campaign to alert consumers of a new tax benefit for auto purchases made between February 16th and the end of this year. If you buy a car anytime this year, you may be able to deduct the cost of any sales and excise taxes. And this provision could save families hundreds of dollars and lead to as many as 100,000 new car sales.
Does that give you hope, Will?
Well, I think that's a wonderful thing, but I also believe that's once again, ignoring exactly what put us here, and that is the loan industry going to be able to give loans? I mean, it's fine to say someone can buy a car and get a tax break, but they would have to come up with the money out of their pocket. It's the loans that got us in trouble. You know,
right.
We've got the products, but if a person cannot go out and buy cash money for a vehicle, then we're right back in the same boat. And there's where the problem is getting people loans to be able to buy these vehicles. That's what tore our market up.
Well, two great takeaways from both of you straight from the line there in Pontiac. Terry saying that the pensions of the workers, even with 31 and a half years experience, are on the line if GM goes into bankruptcy. And as Will just said, it's the credit markets unfreezing that's going to help this market, nothing else. Will and Terry, a new slogan for the car industry if it gets reconstituted under this plan from Barack Obama? Will?
Well, my slogan, which has been for a lot of years, I don't know if it's new, but we've always teased about General Motors building tomorrow's vehicles with yesterday's tools. So that's pretty much the way we do it.
Ouch. Terry Harden, what's your slogan?
Well, mine would be that, you know, don't give up on us. We're going to survive. Just don't give up on us.
Nice. Terry Harden, UAW worker for 31 and a half years from the GM Assembly Center in Pontiac, Michigan, along with Will Markham, also a UAW worker and our friend here at The Takeaway. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you for having us. Great talking to you again.
So 60 days at GM, but only 30 days for Chrysler to make a deal with Fiat. Joining us now is BBC Rome correspondent David Willey. David, the offer yesterday from Barack Obama was, in theory, if a deal can be done in the next 30 days, there's $6 billion available to Fiat from the U.S. Federal Treasury. Is that attractive? And how is this being covered over there in Rome?
It's very attractive indeed. There's been some very positive comment this morning from the leaders of Italian industry. The president of the Federation of Italian Industries, Emma Marcigaglia, has said that she's really happy. And so has Luca di Montezemolo, who's the president of Fiat and also the president of the Ferrari, which is owned partly by Fiat. So I think there's high expectations here. Even from leading politicians have said that they think this is a very, very good solution. Fiat is Italy's largest private employer, and there's been a lot of worry here in recent years that it was going down the tubes, just like the American car manufacturers. But the arrival on the scene a couple of years ago of Sergio Marchionne, who is an Italian entrepreneur, who's spent a lot of time in the United States and in Canada, seems to have turned the fortunes of Fiat around.
Hmm. Well, you know, one interesting thing is, and I'm wondering how that plays in Europe, is, you know, Fiat, in theory, is getting Chrysler for, you know, a tenth or less of what Cerberus bought it for, and maybe a 100th of what Daimler, the Germans, bought it for. Not bad.
Could be a very, very good deal, but don't lose sight of the fact that the car industry in Europe here is also in a state of some flux as a result of the global meltdown. Fiat has been looking around very carefully for a suitable partner, because I think Sergio Marchionne realizes that alone, Fiat can't do it. It's been looking for an alliance. And now, with the Chrysler deal, I see the Financial Times in London is suggesting that it could be a deal which is also going to bring the French Peugeot group into this new alliance. So I think we have to see over the next 30 days, as you were saying, what's going to happen.
Why did the Fiat stock go down yesterday?
Well, it's gone up today.
It's gone up today, okay.
Yeah.
So it's bouncing around.
Yeah, it's bouncing around, and this morning it's up. It was up 7.8% when the markets opened. So, you know, I think everybody here is pretty happy about. And Mr. Marchionne himself is in the United States already negotiating. So, the hope here is that something will happen. You see, Fiat for many years although it was an international company, it had a big monopoly inside in the domestic market here. Everybody in Italy used to buy Fiat cars. Well, this all changed 10, 15 years ago.
And I guess the real issue potentially is that both companies will be further internationalized from this deal. 30 days from now, if Fiat and Chrysler get it together, it will internationalize both of them. Correspondent David Willey from Rome and the BBC. David, thanks so much.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
New slogan for the new car industry, go with names that work. Click and clack and barack.
That's good. We're looking for new slogans for the auto industry. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Those guys need to do a show where there's no laughs. Are they still laughing? Those guys? Click and clack. They're still laughing? They have nothing to laugh about. So we can't let the auto industry vanish. That's what Barack Obama says. But we do need some new slogans. Simon Johnson, former chief economist at the IMF. You're a good person to ask for a new slogan for a possibly nationalized car industry. What do you think?
We fired one uncooperative CEO. We can fire more.
Nice. So the reason we asked you on the program is to talk about, first of all, a provocative series of comments you made in the Atlantic magazine. But let me give you a number here. According to Bloomberg this morning, the U.S. government and the Federal Reserve have spent, lent, or guaranteed $12.8 trillion. And that amount approaches the value of everything produced in the United States last year to stem the longest recession since the 1930s. It's getting close to U.S. GDP. Now, Simon Johnson, what does that mean about the precariousness or the vulnerability or the state of the U.S. economy as it attempts to lead everyone out of this financial meltdown?
Well, what it means is obviously we built a huge unsustainable financial sector that basically can't function anymore, and the government, mostly the Federal Reserve, but also to some extent the Treasury, has stepped in to provide a backstop, or maybe the front stop, for almost all credit currently flowing in the U.S. economy. It's an extraordinary situation, and I think quite unprecedented.
But there are parallels to, at least in monetary terms, in standard economics for, you know, what happens now to a country that, A, gets into this position and now must do this, including the printing of money, as some have said, to get out of it?
Well, the big question is, yes, there's a parallels, but to what? Is it a situation we're more accustomed to in the U.S. where, because we have rising unemployment, we can print a lot of money, as you said, and not generate too much inflation? That, I think, is what the Fed is betting on. Or have we become more like an emerging market, let's say a Russia or a Korea or, heaven forbid, an Argentina, where the printing of money will create inflation even though unemployment is rising? We really don't know the kind of structure that we've got ourselves into.
But it could be Argentina. And remind people what happened in Argentina when in the most recent collapse, where the currency basically went up in smoke in that nation.
Well, yeah, Argentina's had, unfortunately, a regular, somewhat repeated collapse over the past century, which followed the exact same pattern, that they have a period of low inflation, a period when people think that they've fundamentally transformed their economy, and then some big imbalances, particularly the budget that gets out of control. They print money, and that turns into inflation, either gradually or, in the most recent case, quite suddenly and spectacularly, when they had a currency board that collapsed about 7 years ago now. So you can do this in many different ways. These are emerging market dynamics that are obviously totally different from what we're accustomed to in the United States. And, you know, hopefully, while we've got some of the same pathologies, particularly a dysfunctional financial sector, we haven't got exactly those macroeconomic dynamics. Because if that is where we're heading, then it's going to be much tougher.
Is there a clock ticking in terms of when inflationary pressures become too great to resist? And does the economy need to turn around in, say, the next 18 months, 9 months, 9 weeks?
Well, the economy obviously needs to turn around as quickly as it can. Realistically, I think we're looking at late in 2010. There's much more problems to work through in the financial sector. I think the new resolution authority that the government is seeking will be used to sort out some of the big financial institutions. and there's a fair amount of restructuring still to come there. Once you get through that, I think that there are some natural processes for recovery in the United States. I'm more worried actually about the global economy and how other people around the world are going to be able to hold up in the face of shocks they get from us and from themselves.
Right. Well, we should note that late 2010 recovery is considerably more pessimistic than the Obama administration, at least in their public statements. So the other reason I wanted to talk with you, Simon, is, you know, the IMF at the G20 summit, which happens this week in London, is certainly on the table for some reform or at least a bailout to be able to better assist nations that are stuck in the middle here. What do you think is the likely change at the IMF?
Oh, I think there's going to be big change at the IMF. I think that is actually the main item at the G20 this week. The IMF is going to get a lot more funding, perhaps up to a tripling of its available resources. And then the key question is, to what extent the IMF can sort of change its role in the world? Can it become regarded as much more a friendly partner with countries and somebody to whom you turn more readily for loans? And that is the goal, and that's what the G20 wants. It's a tough task. Obviously, there's a lot of history and a lot of baggage to overcome, but people are working on this pretty hard.
But the IMF, it seems, in a very, very quick period, has been transformed from almost a colonial body that sort of dictates monetary policy to nations to now being more like a folksy savings and loan for middle-level countries, really unable to deal with the large-scale impacts of the financial crisis.
Well, I think they would like to think of themselves more, at least in part, as a credit cooperative. Obviously, they do give loans to countries where no one else will lend money, and that's always going to be a very important role for the IMF. And when a country like Belarus or Ukraine comes to you for a loan, it's only reasonable and realistic to ask for some conditions and ask them to do some things. But more generally, they'd like to be a place where you go to for liquidity money, just like you go to your friends, if you have friends at the Federal Reserve or the European Central Bank. They'd like to be regarded as a partner for major central banks around the world on the same basis. And that's a big reason why they're seeking this, and I think they're going to receive this additional funding this week.
Friends like the IMF, it's on the table, reform on the table at the G20. My guest, Simon Johnson, former chief economist at the IMF and co-founder of the influential Baseline Scenario blog about the global economy. We're just discussing the question of whether the U.S. is more like China or Argentina in this crisis. Now, Mark Garrison has some headlines.
Thank you, John. Coming up on 29 minutes after the hour, Health Secretary nominee Kathleen Sebelius faces the first of two Senate hearings today. She'll meet with the Senate Health Committee. It's unclear whether the chairman, Senator Ted Kennedy, will be there because of his brain cancer.
You need to go to the Senate Health Committee. Okay, like you're going to keel over.
Sebelius would play a major role in the White House plan to overhaul the country's health care system. The Senate Finance Committee will question her on Thursday. New GM CEO Fritz Henderson has 60 days to come up with a plan good enough to convince the government to give the carmaker more bailout money. Fritz says he won't rule out bankruptcy but favors restructuring to keep the company afloat instead. In international news, a Taliban leader in Pakistan now claims responsibility for yesterday's deadly attack on a police academy in Lahore. He says the attack is a response to the U.S. drone attacks on militants in the Pakistani northwest. Finally, off the coast of Libya, hundreds are feared dead after boats carrying African migrants sank earlier this week. John?
Maybe fewer cigars in the morning would help, Mark.
I don't smoke, man. Don't blame that.
Thanks, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. A lot of calls from all of you on our challenge to come up with some new slogans for the auto industry. Some of you are using some old slogans, giving some variations on some old auto slogans.
This is John Street from Austin, Texas. Baseball, hot dogs, socialize with Chevrolet.
They go together, they go together. In the good old USA, Big Spinner Satellite Radio, endorsement deals and Chevrolet.
Makes sense to me.
Tell us your slogan at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. So the president faced the microphones yesterday. You saw it and had a very stern face and voice for both General Motors and Chrysler.
Each company has submitted a plan to restructure. But after careful analysis, we've determined that neither goes far enough to warrant the substantial new investments that these companies are requesting. And so today I'm announcing that my administration will offer GM and Chrysler a limited additional period of time to work with creditors, unions, and other stakeholders to fundamentally restructure in a way that would justify an investment of additional taxpayer dollars.
So hours earlier, President Obama and the administration had announced that Rick Wagoner, the CEO of General Motors, was asked to step down. What is the precedent for this confrontation or collaboration, whatever you want to call it, with a major American industry? David Sanger joins us. He's chief Washington correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. He's author of The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power. We might change your subtitle to The World Obama is Changing as we speak. David Sanger, first of all, thanks for joining us. And what's the precedent?
Good to be back with you.
Yeah, what's the precedent here? It was reminiscent to me of JFK and the steel industry, the sort of jawboning episode, but there's a lot different.
Well, I think that the steel industry analogy we might want to reach for is Truman in 1952, when he took over the steel companies briefly because there was a strike that had been called by the United Steelworkers, and he literally nationalized the industry. It only lasted about a month. The Supreme Court stepped in and told him he didn't have the powers to do it, which then raises the question, how does Barack Obama get the powers to do it? And the answer is he's not literally nationalizing. What he's doing in this particular case is, since he's the only one with any money left out here that might get lent to these two car makers, he's saying it's my way or you never see the highway.
Well, you know, in Truman's case, he tried to just literally take over the steel industry. JFK tried to jawbone the steel industry to reduce its prices. Here, you've got a combination. Although Obama is attempting to sort of do it with the power of the Treasury, not so much with the power of the court.
Yeah, this is well beyond jawboning. When you tell the chairman of the company that it really is time for him to go and he leaves, that's not the usual back and forth between, you know, the government has jawboned many industries over many times. The concern here is that at the moment that President Obama ends up basically making the key decisions for the auto industry, however temporarily, he owns it. And he owns whatever goes wrong with it. So if this whole effort doesn't work out, he'll be the one now taking the blame, not GM management.
Well, two things. I mean, how did this decision about Rick Wagoner come down? And, you know, extending on your point there, does Barack Obama have to come up with a GM car in 60 days, say a green vehicle that delivers health care in the glove compartment?
It would be nice, but I think what he does have to do is the first thing they have to do is the government will take an active role in paring down the number of nameplates. So, you know, if Pontiac goes away, if the Buick division is half its size, if certain models, you know, disappear, then this is your last moment to buy a Pinto, right? then that will be the government's call. And then what they're going to do, I think, is press them into investing much more heavily, not just into the long-range green cars, but into things that will be out on the roads much sooner. And let me give you an example of this. At GM a few years ago, early in the Bush administration, President Bush invited all of the American car makers to go take their models for hydrogen-powered cars, these are all prototypes, and put them out on the South Lawn. Well, they did it, but we're no closer to a hydrogen car. Who didn't he invite at that time? All of the Japanese companies that, partly in America, were making the hybrids. Not a single one was on the South Lawn. What do you see out on the roads? The hybrids. So I suspect that part of what you're going to see the government do at this point is force GM to move into energy efficiency much more quickly.
So did Rick Wagoner say, I don't want to be a part of these new hybrids, or was he literally forced out? Was he told, you know what, somebody's got to go, buddy?
You know, I don't know the backstory to this. I'm in London right now for the G20, and so I did not have time to go try to sort out at the White House who told him. But it doesn't take a whole lot of guesswork
right.
out here to figure out that since Mr. Wagner was telling us a week ago that nobody had suggested to him that he leave, and he had no intention of leaving, somebody suggested to him that he leave.
So how many countries are in the G20? I was trying to figure this out this morning.
Well, you know, you would sit here and think it's a G20. It would be 20 countries, right?
Yeah, I would
and
think
you'd
that,
be
yeah.
wrong. by my
had
count,
a feeling.
By my count, it's 29 now, or at least 29 participants. There's a lot of people around the because the last one of the G20 is supposed to be the European Union. But, of course, the British are here in addition to the European Union president, who's the Prime Minister of Czechoslovakia. The British are here. The Spanish are here because they were running the European Union during the last G20 summit in Washington in November. And so if you had an invitation to the last one, I guess it was still good for this one.
Oh, so it's like at the Kiss concert. Some people have tickets, and other people have tickets and backstage passes and stuff.
And backstage passes. Right. And you know who else has got a backstage pass? The head of the UN, the head of the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund has got one. So they're all here. And then you've got, you know, Brazil and China and Indonesia and Italy and Japan and Russia. The Saudis will be here. South Africans, Turkey. It's going to be a big crowd, which then raises the question, how do you remake the architecture of the international economy in one day with 29 people around the table? And the answer to that is you don't.
Well, to say nothing of the fact that if they can't count to 20 and they're going to fix the financial crisis, okay, fine. You know, I'm pretty smart, but I'm not that smart. What's a slogan for the new car industry, David, before we go?
The bankrupt Pep Boys.
Great. David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times and author of The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts, and The Challenges to American Power. Mark Garrison, you got some headlines?
Thank you, John. 20 minutes before the hour, federal food safety officials want consumers to stop eating foods with pistachios, at least for now. The Food and Drug Administration is looking at a possible salmonella link. In North Dakota, the levees are holding so far, but they're still watching the Red River as a blizzard roars through. There's been plenty of snow and powerful winds. The Red River has dropped very slowly, but again, it's still more than 20 feet above flood stage. There's more violence in the Middle East today. At least 8 were killed and a dozen wounded in northern Iraq. A suicide bomber attacked a police station there. This is on the same day that British forces in the south have transferred command over to the U.S., kind of the beginning of the end of the British presence in Iraq. John.
And Hugo Chavez wants to create a new currency based on oil?
I predict it will be a volatile currency.
He's in Qatar. Yes, that's interesting. Thanks, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. The BBC's David Loin joined us from The Hague earlier today, where more than 70 countries are convened to discuss Afghan reconstruction. And when we spoke, I asked David whether he thought the U.S. was declaring at this summit that Afghanistan was now primarily an American operation instead of one that required as much NATO cover.
It's certainly Americanizing the operation, but the United States is still looking for significant NATO support. They're not looking for more troops, though. They're looking for civilian support on the ground and money to go into the aid program with a real awareness. And speaker after speaker here at The Hague has talked about the failure of aid programs over the last 7 years since the Taliban fell in Afghanistan, the aid effectiveness not working. The president of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, said people come to these international conferences and pay lip service to giving us money in an effective way, but it never happens. And I think the real message for America from Secretary of State Clinton was that this is the long game. America is really committing itself to Afghanistan for some time. She quoted an Afghan proverb saying, patience is bitter, but its fruit is sweet. So, i.e., there could be cost in the short term, but in the long term, it's a game worth playing from her point of view.
Is there patience to deal with Iran at this conference? And the role of Iran is really one of the big mysteries and unveilings that we may see at this meeting.
Well, do you know, Hillary Clinton arrived quite early at the conference this morning, and just 5 minutes later, Mehdi Akhundzadeh, the Iranian deputy foreign minister, arrived. Neither said whether they had met in the corridors of this conference, but I'd be surprised if there weren't some contact between the delegations, the first really at this level for 30 years since contacts were broken off, of course, when the Ayatollah Khomeini took over Iran in 1979. And effectively took Americans hostage in the embassy there. So there is a real sense that if they don't get Iran, Iranian involvement, Russian involvement, Pakistan, China, India, all of the regional neighbors and the big Central Asian republics to the north of Afghanistan, then the country cannot be stable. But the challenge to America is that many of those countries don't agree with each other on much, and they certainly don't have goodwill towards everything in Afghanistan or towards America. So there's a huge amount of diplomacy to go if this policy is to work.
And, I mean, but it is the case that this is the first time getting all of the regional neighbors bordering Afghanistan to cooperate has even really been tried since 9/11.
It seems extraordinary, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But there was this great wave of international support for America after 9/11. But I think a lot of that was dissipated in the way that President Bush framed the agenda. We heard intriguingly from Secretary of State Clinton on her way over here that the words "war on terror" will not pass her lips. She said the absence of these words surely says all that we need to say. They're not. Now talking about a war on terror, they're talking about a far more imperial project in a sense for America, yeah. A nation-building project in Afghanistan.
Well, quickly, David, you've got a big book coming out in Afghanistan here in the States. Any chance you'll need to rewrite it based on this meeting?
I've tried to get it as up-to-date as possible. It goes back over the last 200 years of history in Afghanistan, but certainly the last few years have kept me writing right up to the wire on it.
BBC's David Loyne spoke to us earlier this morning from The Hague, where he's covering the Afghanistan conference today that includes 70 countries. This just breaking, Sun-Times Media Group, owner of the Chicago Sun-Times and a number of suburban newspapers in Chicago, filed for bankruptcy, adding to a long list.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. A global leader contemplates a moment in history and his lifelong confrontation with the People's Republic of China. That coming up in a moment. First, headlines from Mark Garrison.
Thank you, John. 12 minutes before the hour, President Barack Obama is now on the way to the UK, the first stop on a trip that will take him to five countries. A main event is the G20 summit in London on Thursday. Leaders from the largest global economies will address the international financial meltdown. France is already threatening to walk out on the meeting. The finance minister says France's president will not sign an agreement unless it has beefed up financial regulation stronger than the U.S. or U.K. has asked for. Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu will be sworn in as the country's next prime minister today. This on the heels of news that a military investigation into alleged atrocities in the Gaza conflict will not lead to charges. The Israeli military says the accusations were made based on hearsay. Human rights organizations say the finding will make it harder for soldiers to speak out about future violations.
Thank you, Mark. And we're up to date. Obama says we can't let the auto industry vanish, but we need some new slogans. Troy, our friend, has some experience being underwater there in North Dakota. Maybe he's got a slogan for the car companies underwater in Detroit.
I hate to say it, but new auto industry slogan is doom, 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 with a capital D.
Naughty Troy, tell us your slogan at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. So 50 years ago today, the Tibetan spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama, crossed the border from Tibet into India. The move followed an uprising of Tibetans against Chinese rule on the Tibetan plateau. Thinking about that half century, the Dalai Lama had something to say about what's going on in his Tibet, which is considered to be an independent nation by Tibetans, but is actually a province of the People's Republic of China.
Things are still going on very badly inside Tibet. For that,
unfortunately, after 50 years, still basically the same way, and in some cases even worse.
Joining us now is Pico Iyer, renowned travel writer, novelist, essayist, author of numerous books, including The Open Road, The Global Journey of the 14th Dalai Lama. He's in the studio with us. Pico, first of all, thanks for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here.
I wanted to talk with you because your piece in the New York Review of Books a couple of weeks ago really described the longstanding relationship you have with the Dalai Lama and how this current moment is really a moment of tremendous soul-searching for the Dalai Lama as he thinks about the future of his nation and his own personal future.
Yes, I've known him for 35 years, and you're right, I've never seen him as unsettled and as outspoken as he's been in the last year, and I think that's a register of what he's hearing is happening in Tibet itself. As we heard on that soundbite, the Chinese are cracking down more rigorously and intensely than ever on the Tibetans. And so the Dalai Lama has this strange situation whereby Tibet as a global phenomenon has become more successful and better respected than anyone could have hoped for. But Tibet in Tibet is on the brink of extinction. Mm. So he says it's on the verge of a death sentence, really.
Well, the title of your article is Hell on Earth, yet there were some really compelling, hopeful signs in your conversations with the Dalai Lama, particularly how much he supports the economic success of China and how much he believes in his heart that ultimately the Chinese are going to need the spiritual underpinnings of Tibetan Buddhism to make it through these hard times.
Exactly. He always speaks for interdependence. So that's why he's not one of those Tibetans who says Tibet should be totally independent. He says Tibet has a lot to gain from China because China is a strong, powerful, mighty economic machine, and China has a lot to gain from Tibet. And so he's always looking for the common ground. And one surprising thing that many people don't know about is how many Chinese, Han Chinese, are now turning to mm-hmm. Tibetan Buddhism. They're suddenly their material needs are taken care of, but they're calling for something to guide them spiritually.
In sheer numbers, it would be as though the state of Idaho attacked the United States is the sort of the asymmetric quality of this conflict. Yet, if you throw in the Buddhist element, the spiritual underpinnings, and the Dalai Lama's longstanding relationship with people like Mao and Deng Xiaoping, there's a lot more at stake. The Dalai Lama thinks on some level he's carrying both Chinese nationalism and Tibetan nationalism in his own narrative.
Yes, and I think his question is exactly what's China so scared of? They outnumber Tibetans by 200-1, as you say. It's not a significant part of the larger picture, and China would have so much to gain by giving Tibetans just basic freedom of speech and of worship. But you're right. He spent a whole year in China in 1954-55. Was very very close to Mao Zedong, who treated him almost as a son, and so he feels that why is China still clinging to this very outdated rhetoric and not giving freedom to Tibetans.
So there are some who have said that the Dalai Lama, and even he in your article, suggested that his own strategy had failed in some sense of bringing the Chinese on board. And others have described it maybe even more harshly as he spent maybe too much time with American celebrities like Richard Gere and Brad Pitt or who others, and maybe more time should have been spent with Chinese leaders to develop a constituency within China. How do you evaluate that?
I don't think there's any solidity to the second point. I think one thing he's realized is he goes and meets all the leaders of the world. They're all keen to meet him, but none of them can really stand up to China. So actually, people like Richard Gere have done much more for the Tibetans than the White House or the mm-hmm. European Parliament. But he has been saying last few months especially, that his policy has failed. And one reason he's doing that is that China keeps on saying that the Dalai Lama is the source of this problem. So he says, fine, if I am the source of the problem, I'll just remove myself. Now, please, will you come to a reasonable, peaceful settlement with the Tibetan people?
In one of the passages in your story in the New York Review that really, I think, is quite sad. You hear the Dalai Lama suggesting that he might be outdated, that the institution of the Dalai Lama itself may have outlived its usefulness, and that for Tibet to go it on an independence road, even a partial independence road, would mean that he would have to step away and that there wouldn't be a successor. Do you believe that?
It's very possible, but I think the wonderful thing about this Dalai Lama is he's a great pragmatist and a realist more than anything. So he's been leader of his people for 69 years, and I think what he was saying was the Dalai Lama institution was perfect for the previous era. Now that many of us are in exile and that Tibet is split, we need a new kind of leadership. And I think actually that's a step forward. He's not giving up so much as coming up with a very resourceful and imaginative response to the situation. New circumstances require new solutions. And I think the next Tibetan leader may not be called the Dalai Lama, but will in fact be as powerful as the current one.
Well, before we go then, let's end on the details of what it is like in Tibet. And these are grim details that both you've managed to learn and the Dalai Lama is attempting to convey again and again and again, the arrests, the beatings. What is it like in Tibet?
People are beaten even as the minute they're arrested now. An 80-year-old man was recently taken in just because he asked why monks should be imprisoned. You can be imprisoned right now in Tibet just for calling your friends and relatives in America and telling them what's going on there. So it's harder and bleaker than ever before.
And so the sources that we have, academics up at Columbia University, et cetera, who we speak to all the time, who tell us what's going on in Tibet, suddenly their sources are subject to arrest.
Yes, and their sources are still speaking because the Tibetans have grown used to standing up to Chinese authority. But it's much more treacherous than it was 2 years ago. And if you go to Lhasa, the capital of Tibet now, it looks like Las Vegas.
And tourism is open. The Chinese have said that tourists can come back. And if tourists should go to Tibet now, they would see a beautiful place, but they would also see a place that is sort of a part of a Chinese facade that everything is peaceful.
Yes, but luckily there are cracks in the facade, and it's a great development and a sign forward that tourists can go, because any tourist who goes there comes back with stories that she shares with all her friends. And China has sort of hidden Tibet behind a black wall for the last year. And now that it's opened up, I think that's a small piece of hope for the Tibetans.
Finally, with the Dalai Lama out of the picture, do Tibetans become more militant? Does this become more violent?
That's always the fear. He has a democratically elected prime minister there, and whenever votes are taken, 60-70% vote for his nonviolent course. But if even 20% of Tibetans call for violence, sadly that will bring more suffering on the Tibetans in Tibet as well as the Han Chinese.
Something worth remembering and noting, 50 years after the exile of the Dalai Lama and the beginning of the period of instability and striving for independence that the Tibetans struggle for even today. Pico Iyer, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Pico Iyer, renowned travel writer, novelist, essayist, the author of numerous books, including The Open Road, The Global Journey of the 14th Dalai Lama. So we've got our minds on Detroit today, and we need the people of Detroit to help us, to help President Obama. President Obama, of course, announced a short lease for GM and Chrysler yesterday, but we need new slogans to get those companies and American cars back into popularity. Beyond See the USA in your Chevrolet, a new slogan for a new, perhaps nationalized auto industry. Come on, people.
John from Long Island, and on the positive side, driving America into better times.
You could do better than that. Richard in Nyack, New York has a good one, too. Hi, we're the U.S. auto industry. We're too big to fail and too incompetent to succeed. Okay, snarky is fine. Detroit, we want to hear from you. Call us. Tell us your new slogan for the new auto industry. It's your auto industry at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Here's your takeaway.
What do you see out on the roads? The hybrids. So I suspect that part of what you're going to see the government do at this point is force GM to move into energy efficiency much more quickly.
Not a slogan exactly, but analysis from David Sanger at our partner, the New York Times. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Some questions for General Motors from the President.
They must ask themselves, have they consolidated enough on profitable brands? Have they cleaned up their balance sheets, or are they still saddled with so much debt that they can't make future investments?
Have you driven a Ford?
Have you driven a Ford lately? Might be the hidden message from the Obama administration to ailing GM and Chrysler. At the end of the day, what will the U.S. auto industry look like? Ford and Toyota? Auto's New Deal. Below manufacturer suggested retail price on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, March 31st. Adora Udoji is away, spending time with her new baby. And coming up this hour, the greenhouse gas glut caused by concrete. And the wired warriors of the U.S. military will take a closer look at the military's predator drones being used in Pakistan. Those stories coming up. The first top headlines. The president is on his way to London at this hour. First stop in what's sure to be a challenging eight-day, five-nation trip. He'll attend Thursday's G20 summit. Also on the agenda, two other summits, numerous bilateral meetings, and a major speech on arms proliferation. Meanwhile, in Detroit, auto workers are reacting to the president's tough new terms for General Motors and Chrysler. Duane Williams works at GM. He says he'll make sacrifices, even a pay cut, but he says it's not fair.
Then we turn around and we see banks being rewarded after they've done a bad job. And here, we're honest auto workers, and we haven't done a bad job. We did our job.
Fritz Henderson's new job is CEO of General Motors. He acknowledged that a strategic bankruptcy with government backing is an option, but a lot can happen between now and the 60-day deadline.
We need to move faster. We need to move deeper. And I think the clear view from their perspective, our perspective, is we're going to do what it takes to get this job done.
Mark Garrison, good morning. What else is going on?
Thank you. We'll start with what just came out a few seconds ago. That's the S&P Case-Shiller Housing Price Index. We saw a record drop, tumbled by 19%. Remember, there's a two-month lag in those numbers, so those are the numbers from January, but down 19% for year over year. Also in the news, there's another salmonella-tainted nut scare, this time with pistachios. The FDA is warning people to stop eating them and foods with them. California public health official Jeff Farrar says the suspect pistachio wholesaler Seton Farms is cooperating fully with a voluntary recall.
The firm is working very hard to collect all the information we have asked for. In fact, the firm is already turning around trucks in transit to bring those back to the facilities.
Over in Fargo, North Dakota, the Red River's still above flood stage, but residents there are currently waiting out a blizzard. The half foot of snow is not likely to be a threat to the river, but the strong up to 40-mile-an-hour winds could put stress on the levees. Also in Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu sworn in as prime minister today.
And a little economic news beyond the housing prices, which is that's an amazing drop in the housing prices you reported. The Dow lost more than 3% yesterday. Asian markets were mixed today. Europe is rallying. Key indices are up nearly 2 to 3%, and the Dow futures suggest a positive bounce off the bottom when the markets open. So we can't let the auto industry vanish. Maybe we need some new slogans then, and that's where you come in. Takeaway audience, you're so good at slogans. Send us yours, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. See the USA and your Chevrolet, Toyota, Ford, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Lots to talk about the auto industry. Barack Obama, of course, yesterday gave marching orders to both GM and Chrysler has 30 days to come up with a deal with Fiat. General Motors has 60 days to restructure. But we're not going to wait. Let's get the slogans out of the way right now. And remember the history, okay? Auto slogans are really a part of America.
See the USA in your Chevrolet. America is asking you to call. Drive your Chevrolet.
Oh, Dinah Shore. I think that's from 1953. But we can't let the auto industry vanish, says Barack Obama. That was then. This is now.
Hi, I'm Greg Scott. I'm from Rhode Island. And here's my slogan for the auto industry. Remember Dinah Shore? Drive the USA into Biscayne Bay, because competition doesn't count at all.
We should just end the program right there. That is perfect. And Biscayne Bay, Biscayne is a Chevy car, I believe. So that's like double reference, okay? Oh, man. Dinah Shore, car slogan. Send us yours at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. So joining us now is Dan Neal, automotive critic for the Los Angeles Times. He joins us, got up very early this morning from California. Dan, thanks for being with us.
Oh, sure. No problem. I was getting up at a few hours anyway.
car slogans are really a part of Americana. The advertising industry was created by the car industry, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. And, thinking about Dinah Shore, seeing the USA and her Chevrolet, when Barack Obama says we can't let the auto industry disappear, simply vanish, there's almost no way for that to happen. What was your reaction to Barack Obama yesterday talking about this American spirit of the auto industry?
Well, a couple of things about that. If the domestic car makers went away, the net number of jobs in the U.S. would probably stabilize about the same. What's happened is that all of these jobs have moved south. And the supply chain for the domestic automakers and the what we call transplant automakers like Mercedes and Toyota and Honda and Hyundai and BMW, they all make cars in the South, right, which are right-to-work states. And so there will always be an auto industry. What really is at stake is the American ownership of a part of the auto industry, and that really is imperiled.
So let's talk. I wanted to spend some time with you just talking about, all right, what if we just thought really broadly here? Forget a specific GM bailout or a specific Chrysler bailout. What if we took all of the car building and car designing and technological resources within the United States, including some of the workforces that you've talked about for Toyota and Hyundai and the German car makers, and reconstituted some American auto company that in theory could produce green cars, would have a technological edge, would not have the liabilities, would have maybe a only partially unionized workforce. What would that consist of? If we cobbled everything together we have within our borders, is there a car company there that could compete favorably and maybe even, very, very well and triumph over the global product lines that are out there?
Well, there are a couple of things. You may be seeing exactly what you're describing come out of bankruptcy. Wagner pretty much owned the argument that the auto companies couldn't go into bankruptcy because it would scare off customers. Well, what happened was that the travails of the auto company, especially GM, scared off customers anyway. So that argument proved not to be valid. And so we are where we are. Okay, so now the car companies are going to go through bankruptcy or a bankruptcy-like proceeding orchestrated by the federal government, however they do it. I personally have called for the temporary nationalization of those companies to effect a bankruptcy-like proceeding. But anyway, so now these companies, they are relieved somewhat of their historical and financial burdens. They managed to get their pension and retirement liabilities off the books. They have managed to close a lot of factories that are redundant. Okay, they're much leaner, they're much smaller, they have much less overhead. They still have, however, a tremendous engineering capability and workforce. The smartest people in the car business are not in Japan. They're not in Munich. There in Detroit.
And Obama really talked about that yesterday and reminded people of that. React to this.
And no one can deny that our auto industry has made meaningful progress in recent years, and this doesn't get talked about often enough. Some of the cars made by American workers right now are outperforming the best cars made abroad.
So is that an argument, Dan Neal, for the federal money to be used to maybe buy the factories that Toyota owns? Toyota's having trouble selling cars. Buy the Hyundai factory, buy some of the factories in Kentucky and Tennessee and make them a part of this new national General Motors, whatever.
Well, it isn't manufacturing. It isn't factory capacity. It isn't updating factories, although there is a Department of Energy program to help pay for modernization of such facilities and also, the suppliers. No, what it is, it's the books. It's the accounting. It's the fact that you have something like 700,000 auto workers, retirees, and pensioners that are have saddled the company with this tremendous overburden, legacy costs. So that's really what has made these companies uncompetitive. And let's face it, they've been poorly managed. They historically, the American companies have not invested in research and technology to the degree the Asian and German companies have. So now there was one other thing though. You said build, you know, fuel efficient cars in the future. Well, that is a money loser. A lot of people join these two things together as if they're they ought to be, you know, that will make these companies financially efficient and they'll make fuel efficient cars. Well, look, you know, Honda and Toyota have hybrids sitting on their lots, you know, 100-day supply of them. When the price of gas goes down in this country, people don't buy fuel efficient cars. The Chevy Volt, that is this amazing plug-in hybrid car that Chevy has been GM's been working on, you know, when it comes out, it's going to cost $40,000, and it'll probably cost GM $80,000 to make. And so in the short term, these cars are just not a commercially viable.
So is that an argument for a kind of an Al Gore-style, you know, dollar a gallon, $3 a gallon gas tax?
It is an argument, first, for a substantial, meaningful carbon gas tax, yes, and one that has some teeth in it. When it ratchets up over time, because, you know, we continue to fall into this this trap. Oil prices go down, our buying habits become inappropriate. Then, you know, and then we have to struggle back when gas goes to $4 a gallon, and it will go back. And so that's one thing. We also need to subsidize, both on the manufacturing end and the buying end, these high-tech, next-generation fuel-efficient cars, like plug-in hybrids, until the business case can be made of them. And it
let's focus on what's the infrastructure there. Is that like GM buys Tesla? Is there a place out in Southern California that's doing this kind of work? Is it buying foreign subsidiaries that have this sort of technical R&D?
Well, you know, it happens, I think, more organically than that. For example, Nissan and Renault both have committed. Corporate partnership. Nissan Renault is committed to building electric cars. They're going to build, you know, 100,000 electric cars in the next 5 years. Toyota has and Honda both have sunk considerable resources into battery technology. GM is going to build the Volt, and they've, you know, started to build a factory, or they're trying to build a factory in Michigan to assemble the batteries. It's happening, right? But it's just very, very costly because it's such early days of this technology.
So if the federal government assists GM in doing this and Chrysler goes off to Fiat, is poor Ford out of the picture here? They won't have benefited from any of this? Or are they going to be the only ones standing at the end of the day?
Ford is in a much better position. Ford pushed their chips to in the middle of the table 2.5 years ago. They basically mortgaged the whole company, including the brand itself, the name Ford. They had about $26 billion in working capital that they used to restart the company, and they are in a much better position. They have a lot of European technological competencies. They're bringing the Fiesta to the U.S. next year. That's a car that gets 65.
No, Ford. Ford. I mean, we were talking to UAW workers who wish they were working at Ford. Finally, Bolt in your Volt. Is that the new slogan, Dan Neal?
I like that. It's not bad.
All right. Dan Neal, automotive critic, Pulitzer Prize-winning automotive critic for the Los Angeles Times, talking far and wide about a new auto industry post-60-day deadline for GM. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks, John.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We may not be able to afford to keep our auto industry, or GM and Chrysler. The president wants them reorganized, but can we afford a new slogan? Give us your slogan for a new, possibly nationalized auto industry. Here's a few listeners who've written us some emails. Michael Evers writes, "Listen to the president, ye lug nuts." Ye lug nuts. Fritz writes, "Government auto warranties as user-friendly as an IRS audit." Steve writes, "Where the rubber checks meet the road." Tell us your slogan at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. So we're following up on a very serious story yesterday in Lahore, Pakistan, where a strike was aimed at killing and terrorizing future police officers in that country, demonstrating once again militants' ability to reach deep into the Pakistani heartland. The Taliban in Pakistan are claiming responsibility for the attack, but who's responsible for it is still not entirely clear. More questions are emerging about what the attacks mean for the country, how the U.S. might respond if the Taliban are actually behind it. Urmila Fenigopalan joins us from London now. She's the Asia editor at Jane's Information Group, which publishes magazines focused on military topics, including the well-known Jane's Defense Weekly. Urmila, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
What can you tell us about the significance of this attack? A very bold strike, certainly taking on law enforcement inside Pakistan. It seems to be directed at the very least at the fledgling civilian government inside Pakistan to discredit any sense of security inside Pakistan. Was it successful?
I think you're absolutely right in saying that the attack was primarily targeting law enforcement personnel. This is obviously apparent given that the attack targeted trainee policemen and an earlier attack that that targeted a police station in Islamabad on the 23rd of March. But what's important here is that despite Beitullah Mehsud's claim of responsibility, which I think was likely aimed at creating the impression that his influence extends all the way to Punjab, Pakistan's wealthiest and most populous province, in reality, I think the latest Lahore attack, as well as the previous one earlier this month, was likely carried out by Punjabi jihadi groups rather than Islamist militants operating in the tribal areas.
So let me get this straight. You believe that it's possible that the Pakistani Taliban, Mr. Beitullah Mehsud, claiming responsibility for this attack, is being opportunistic, and that it's much more likely and possibly a signature of Lashkar-e-Taiba, that's the Punjabi militant group, which has caused so many problems in this particular region in Pakistan.
You're right in saying that Lashkar-e-Taiba is a Punjabi jihadi group, but the Lashkar-e-Taiba is a predominantly anti-India, Kashmir-focused terrorist group. And to date, it's never carried out any operations on Pakistani soil. And in light of the recent Mumbai attacks, this group is more likely to kind of stay under the radar and is unlikely to carry out such an attack as the Lahore ones, especially given domestic and international attention that's focused on the groups. There are other key Punjabi jihadi groups, such as Lashkar-e-Jangvi, Jaish-e-Mohammed. And Lashkar-e-Jangvi in particular is believed to have carried out the Islamabad Marriott bombing in September 2008. And suspicion has also fallen on this group for the Lahore Sri Lankan cricket attack team. And but that aside, on the one hand, you have Punjabi jihadi groups and you have these Islamist militants operating in the tribal areas. And Punjabi jihadi groups are known to operate in the tribal areas, suggesting links between these two categories of groups in a way.
Well, it sounds like at the very least that instability in Islamabad is encouraging groups to possibly form alliances they wouldn't otherwise be willing to do. And, maybe more generally, it's a kind of a feeling of open season that this is a window that some of these groups are really taking advantage of, whatever their ideology.
I agree to a certain extent, but I think one mustn't conflate Punjabi jihadi groups with Islamist militants operating in the tribal areas. And I think the reality is that despite Punjab being Pakistan's most populous and wealthiest province, a serious militancy threat emanates from this province. And it is very likely that Punjabi jihadi groups are carrying out the latest string of attacks that we've seen, rather than Islamist militants such as Beitullah Mehsud, Tehrik-e-Taliban, Pakistan.
So is this a distraction for Pakistan, which has suddenly been called on by the the United States government, Barack Obama speaking last Friday, to step up and assist in the offensive against militants in the Northwest province, even including the Taliban on both sides of the border? Or, you know, does the Pakistan government say to the U.S. administration, look, folks, we are so distracted here, you're going to have to handle things yourselves?
The Pakistani civilian government is, you're right, torn. I mean, it's being pulled in different directions. It has to. It has the U.S. on the one hand telling it what it should be doing. It's got these attacks in Punjab. It's got these attacks in the Fatah. But ultimately, I mean, ultimately, Pakistan is facing, in a way, an insurgency on its sort of western frontier bordering Afghanistan, and at the same time is also facing rising militancy in Punjab. So in a way, the poor sort of fledgling civilian government is really under considerable pressure. And on the one hand, you have ongoing UAV strikes by the U.S. in the tribal areas, which is also causing severe sort of domestic opposition to Zardari's regime. So he's under a lot of political pressure as well to kind of stand up to the U.S.
And we're going to have an evaluation of some of those U.S. and NATO tactics in Afghanistan and Pakistan and how it's inflamed militancy in the region later on in the program. Urmila Venugopalan, thanks so much for joining us to set those brutal attacks yesterday in context. Urmila Venugopalan is Asia editor at Jane's Information Group, which publishes magazines focused on military topics, including the very well-known Jane's Defense Weekly. And now Mark Garrison has some more headlines.
Thank you. 28 minutes after the hour, new GM CEO Fritz Henderson has 60 days to come up with a plan good enough to convince the government to give the carmaker more bailout money. Here's where he's starting.
We need to move faster. We need to move deeper. And I think the clear view from their perspective, our perspective, is we're going to do what it takes to get this job done.
Henderson says he won't rule out bankruptcy, but prefers restructuring to keep the company afloat. President Barack Obama is now on the way to the UK. This is his first European trip as president. He'll make the rounds to five different countries over 8 days. First, he lands in London. That's where the G20 summit starts Thursday. Leaders from the largest global economies will address the international financial meltdown. France is threatening to walk out on that meeting. The finance minister says the French president will not sign an agreement unless it has beefed up financial regulation. France wants stronger rules than the U.S. American and British plans have generally emphasized economic stimulus spending first. French and German governments have emphasized new financial regulations. Finally, in international news, Benjamin Netanyahu will be sworn in as Prime Minister of Israel today. That's his second time in the post. He also served in the late 90s, and his swearing-in comes amid news of fresh violence along the Gaza border. John.
Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
We need to move faster. We need to move deeper, and I think the clear view from their perspective, our perspective.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We're professional grade. That was GMC's slogan up till maybe yesterday, where we'd be happy with a paycheck,
Get
might
John.
Be the slogan. Get a grip, John. So remember, have you driven a Ford lately? There's an American car slogan. It was a sign of the times when American cars were tops. Well, Obama says, and he said it yesterday, we can't let the auto industry vanish. So come up with some new slogans, all right?
This is Lee from Brooklyn. I thought of an old schoolyard joke. The auto industry is like a Ronzoni. It runs only when we push it.
Not very hopeful, but tell us your slogan to put the auto industry in drive at 877-8-MY-TAKE. or mytake@thetakeaway.org. So a few months back at the very entertaining and always interesting TED conference, Technology, Entertainment and Design Conference out in Long Beach, California, we talked with Vinod Khosla, the venture capitalist, about the climate change problem, and he simplified it and in only the words that he can use.
I like to simplify the climate problem. I say there's only four problems: coal, oil, cement, and steel. If we solve those four, we are done. We don't have to worry about waiting for other things.
Four problems: coal, oil, cement, and steel. We solve those four, we're done with climate change. Let's work on cement this morning with Henry Fountain, writer for the New York Times and author of today's Science Times article, Concrete is Remixed with Environment in Mind. He's here in the studio with us. Henry, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So cement is a carbon problem. I'm not aware, first of all, that that is the case. I mean, when Vinod told me, I wanted to hear more, but, you know, he talks so fast, we didn't get to it. But it's great that you're here. Why is carbon a cement problem, and what can we do to fix it?
Well, the manufacture of cement produces a lot of carbon dioxide, about 5% of annual global emissions, in fact.
Is it because of some combustion or a chemical reaction, or what's going on?
Well, it's a combination of the two. About 40% of it is just the fossil fuel cost of heating up limestone to 2,700 degrees Fahrenheit. But about half of it is the chemical reaction that occurs when this limestone is burned. CO2 is released, and there's really not much you can do about that.
So remixing concrete with the environment in mind, what does that mean?
Well, there's a couple of ways to approach it. One is, and this happens a lot these days, is to mix other materials, what are called pozzolans, in with cement to reduce the amount of cement and thus reduce the amount of CO2.
Does that produce other sort of environmental byproducts that are equally problematic at the scales of sort of the global cement industry?
Well, not really. In fact, it uses industrial byproducts, things like fly ash, which is the leftover from burning coal, and slag from steel making.
Now, some people have said that the energy industry should really be much more integrated with the building products industry, and that there are a lot of industrial wastes or energy wastes that could be used as building materials if they're taken directly from the waste stream. How could engineers and scientists design a more closed loop to actually capture some of these building materials without releasing all of this carbon?
Well, there are people, in fact, working on different kinds of cement that actually incorporate carbon dioxide from, say, a power plant's flue gases into the process to, in fact, sequester carbon dioxide into concrete.
So power plants would actually also be cement plants.
Right. You'd have essentially a cement plant next door. You'd take the flue gases from the power plant, bubble it through water, say saline water, produce carbonates, and make cement from that. And therefore, you're sequestering maybe a half a ton of CO2 for every ton of cement you make.
Now, I can see scientifically how that could work, but in terms of these industries, they're very, very different. They don't necessarily work together. What would it require to direct that, in fact, that be the case? A cement plant is sited next to an energy plant, and the carbon sequestration results in cement blocks and building materials.
Well, economics might play a role. You know, a power plant is, if carbon taxes come into effect, a power plant's going to have to pay a lot of money for every ton of CO2 that goes up through its smokestack. So if, in fact, they can actually turn around and make cement from that product, they'll be saving a lot of money, so it'll be in their economic interest to do it.
So a cap-and-trade system, if it's aggressive enough, would create alliances between the cement industry and the energy industry.
Right, and in fact, some of these cement companies that are working on developing these processes, the power companies are very interested in it because of the economics.
Way out on the horizon, is there any sort of building material, any sort of abundant resource on the earth that would not involve carbon that could be a building material?
Well, there are other people who are working on, cements that are not, that don't use limestone, that don't use calcium carbonate or any kind of carbonate. Those theoretically would not involve release of CO2 other than heating and transportation and mining and things like that.
Now, how does calcium carbonate work?
Well, calcium carbonate is basically it's limestone, and it's the building block of Portland cement, which has been around for about 200 years.
Calcium carbonate, it would be hard to find a replacement for calcium carbonate.
Well, it's just the biggest, it's the most ubiquitous cement in the world by far. It's been used. It's very effective. It's very cement-like. One of the problems with all these other materials that are in development is that there's all these standards that have to be met for strength of concrete, for durability, et cetera, et cetera. Nobody's been able to figure that out yet, but they hope to.
Silicon is abundant. Does it have any hope of being a cement?
Well, I don't know if it has hope of being a cement by itself, but in fact, a waste product called silica fume is used as a replacement for some cement in concrete.
Any products that exist now that begin to address the issues in your article?
Nothing that's really on the market yet. There's a company in California named Calera, which your VC guy is involved with.
Yes, indeed.
Absolutely. And they are, they're hoping to produce within a year or two either cement or maybe artificial aggregate stone to go into concrete.
Not something you'd want to put on your table, but the recipe is in the current issue of Science Times. My guest, Henry Fountain, writer for the New York Times, is the author of the article, Concrete is Remixed with the Environment in Mind. Mark Garrison has some more headlines.
Thank you, John. 21 minutes before the hour, the president's choice for health secretary has the first of two Senate confirmation hearings today. Kansas Democratic Governor Kathleen Sebelius is expected to get a friendly reception at the Senate Health Committee today. She's the president's second choice for the post. You'll remember former Senate Democratic leader Tom Daschle pulled out amid tax problems. Sebelius goes before the Senate Finance Committee next Thursday. So far, the levees are holding, but North Dakota is still watching the Red River as a blizzard roars through. There's been plenty of snow and powerful winds. The winds especially are a problem because they can stress the levees. The river is still more than 20 feet above flood stage, though it has been slowly dropping. Schools and businesses are closed for a second week. The U.S. Justice Department has agreed to transfer a Yemeni inmate from the Guantanamo Bay prison, but won't say where he's going. The detainee has been held at Gitmo since 2002. He was detained in Afghanistan, accused of helping al-Qaeda. The 38-year-old doctor says he was on a humanitarian mission at the time. Finally, a new study shows Hispanic students have become more segregated in suburban public schools during the last decade. That's despite a reverse trend for African Americans and Asians. The report comes from the Pew Hispanic Center. Researchers say one factor may be the growth of suburban charter schools. They often specialize in ethnic or bilingual courses, and the study suggests they may contribute to the isolation of certain groups.
So Hispanic students more segregated in suburban public schools.
Correct.
And that's a trend over the last 10 years.
Compared to other groups.
That's interesting. Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway, and I'm John Hockenberry. Sometimes, you know, I think of this show as a conversation with you folks, you know, the listeners. And this morning, we're looking for a new slogan for a possibly nationalized car industry. Sometimes turning around your fortunes really centers around a mantra.
You're not here to kill me. Figure that part out for myself.
I figured that out, but Chevrolet figured this out a long time ago.
See the USA in your Chevrolet. America's asking you to call. Drive your Chevrolet through the USA.
Back when they were a success, Chevy had that slogan, and there's Have You Driven a Ford Lately? Much, much later. But hey, if we're all loaning Detroit some cash, then let's also give them some ideas for some new slogans.
Hello, this is Aaron from Norwalk, Connecticut. And my new slogan for the automotive industry is like a rock dropping on your foot.
Like a rock.
Ow, like a rock. And lots more of you cribbed off earlier successful car slogans, too. And bonus points for those that who sang them as well.
This is John Street from Austin, Texas. Baseball, hot dogs, socialize with Chevrolet.
They go together.
You know, we always here at The Takeaway think rapping is good.
My name's Shannon. I'm from Detroit, representing I've Got a Rap. Don't dodge the issue. We must forward ahead. In general, our motor industry is dead. America is running out of ways to levy before soon we'll be turning to Hugo Chevy, 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 Chevy.
A conversation with the listeners. That's what we think of this show. What about using an aphorism?
Dan Gutman from Westfield, New Jersey. The slogan is, where the flubber meets the road.
And we also talked to one man in the middle of it all earlier today, GM worker Will Markham. What's a slogan from an experienced GM line worker like himself?
General Motors building tomorrow's vehicles with yesterday's tools.
All snark aside, some of you definitely aren't as cynical as they are or I am. I mean, we all need some hope here.
John from Long Island, and on the positive side, driving America into better times.
Hi, this is Sarah from Brooklyn, and my take is, yes, we can drive into the future.
And if hope doesn't fill your tank?
Hi, my name is William Griffin from Detroit. Having just introduced my five-year-old grandson to Star Wars this weekend, I suggest we turn to old Lee. Help us, Iacocca. You're our only hope.
Lee Iacocca. Boy, those were the days. You know, a good slogan sometimes hinges on wit and a certain kind of stickiness. How about using some wordplay with the Commander-in-Chief's name?
Hi, my name is Leslie, and my suggestion is not your father's Oldsmobile.
New slogan for the new car industry, go with names that work. Click and Clack and Barack.
60 days, that's how many days the president has given General Motors, and Chrysler gets 30 days to get on the right track with Fiat. We'll bring you coverage up to those dates, but in the meantime, here's one slogan the General Motors worker, Terry Harden, is telling himself and the rest of America.
Don't give up on us. We're going to survive. Just don't give up on us.
There's a slogan. Yours at 8778-MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. There, I get it.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm a cybernetic organism, living tissue over a metal endoskeleton.
Terminators over Afghanistan, robot warriors causing problems in South Asia. In a moment, first, headlines from Mark Garrison.
Thank you, John. I have some bad economic news, but it's probably better than the whole civilization being outlawed, you know, annihilated by Skynet. So we'll move on from that. The S&P Case-Shiller Price Index showed a record decline in home values for January, sliding 19% from a year ago. That news was much worse than expected. Later this morning, new consumer confidence numbers come out. Economists expect a slight bump in those numbers.
You were just showing off there, Skynet.
Hey, you like, remember
you're just showing off. You're just showing off.
Hey, you played the clip. In the moving cars, GM's new CEO, Fritz Henderson, has 60 days to come up with a plan good enough to convince the government to authorize more bailout money. But GM veteran Terry Harden told The Takeaway this morning that the new CEO has not convinced him yet.
With 31 and a half years seniority, I feel that I really have no more sense of security than when I started over 30 years ago.
Fritz Henderson, the new CEO, still has to talk to GM bondholders and the union to see about getting new concessions to make GM viable long term. And in international news, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Afghan President Hamid Karzai offered an olive branch to Taliban fighters who have rejected al-Qaeda. This came during a conference held today to help rebuild Afghanistan. Karzai and Clinton urged delegates at the conference to offer Taliban fighters, quote, an honorable form of reconciliation. John.
And they are actual human organisms, Hillary
yes.
Clinton and Hamid Karzai?
Non-cyber.
Borgs. Right, right. But in Afghanistan, Terminators and robot warriors are actually real. They're an old idea from Hollywood.
How could that man just get up after you did?
It's not a man. Machine. Terminator. Underneath, it's a hyper-alloy combat chest. Microprocessor controlled. Fully armored. Very tough. But outside, it's living human tissue.
They cannot make things like that yet.
Not yet. Not for about 40 years.
Are you saying it's from the future?
Well, some robots are from the present, and they're used on battlefields all over the world. P.W. Singer joins us. He's the author of the new book, Wired for War, The Robotics Revolution and Conflict in the 21st Century. He's also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, where he serves as the director of the 21st Century Defense Initiative. P.W. Singer, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Predator drones are a popular weapon both in Afghanistan and certainly were popular in Iraq. Would you call them robots in the sense that maybe Hollywood has envisioned robot warriors?
They're
They're not in the way Hollywood has, but they certainly meet the definition of a robot in terms of being able to sense, think, and act, and most particularly take the man out of the action. And, you know, the interesting thing is the Predator is just the start of something much bigger here. We went into Iraq with a handful of these kind of drones. We now have over 7,000 in the inventory. And things are going so fast in terms of the technology, we're one day going to look on the Predators as almost the same way we look at the Model T Fords or the Wright Brothers Flyer.
But there are downsides. I mean, there are battlefield consequences to using robots versus using humans, and avoiding casualties is not the only one. What is the downside? And we've seen it again and again in discussions of political instability in Pakistan every time a drone flies overhead in Northwest Frontier Province.
Oh, these are very much a revolutionary technology. And the thing with revolutionary technologies is they rewrite the rules of the game, and they have consequences that are both good and bad. So in Pakistan, for example, they've been incredibly effective. We've gotten 11 out of the top 20 al-Qaeda leaders that we've killed, not with boots on the ground, not with manned bombers, but with these unmanned drones. But they also are having an impact on the wider, what we call, war of ideas. You know, imagine that, robots having an impact on the very human war of ideas. So, for example, the leading newspaper of Pakistan described the U.S. as enemy number one. One of the most popular songs in Pakistan last year talked about America fighting an honorless war, looking at Pakistanis the same way that we look at insects. And so we're getting very good at getting the top leaders of this organization, but we may be also very good at convincing 12-year-old boys to join it.
Well, and it's not simply Pakistan where this is an issue. You quote Rami Khoury, the legendary journalist in Beirut, describing what happened during the Israeli offensive in Lebanon against Hezbollah, that the use of robotic weapons enhances the spirit of defiance, you write in your book, and that the enemy is using machines to fight from afar. Your defiance in the face of those machines shows your heroism, your humanity. Take the beating and keep fighting back. That, in a sense, fighting these machines shows a kind of courage that is actually a recruitment tool for militant organizations.
Exactly. And it shows this disconnect in the war of ideas between the message you think you're sending and the message that's being received. And I remember also talking with a very senior Bush administration official who said, you know, these technologies, quote, play to our strength. The thing that scares people is our technology. But as you note there, it's a very different story when you go around and ask those people. And I remember besides the quote from Rami Khoury, that who's, you know, again, the editor of one of the leading newspapers of Lebanon, he also said, it makes you look like cowards. It makes you look like you're not man enough to come out and fight. Another Pentagon analyst, I think, put it pretty well, where he said, we have the optics of this look really freaking bad. It makes us look like the evil empire in Star Wars, and the other side look like the Rebel Alliance.
And how does that complicate the attempts to create sort of political alliances in Pakistan, in Afghanistan? That's what Barack Obama was talking about with his entire security team raid last Friday, unveiling this new policy where South Asia and Afghanistan in particular is at the center of the U.S. fight against insurgencies around the world. Drones don't necessarily help any of that.
Well, they do and they don't. And the key here is finding that balance, because we know that in these insurgencies, you don't win them through military means alone. You've got to create a context in which you can come to a political conclusion. You've got to create a context where the local populace is willing to turn against the insurgents. You've got to create socioeconomic development. You need all those things. But there's also a hard reality of these insurgencies. At the end of the day, there are some, you know, leaders on the insurgent side that need to be put in the ground. There's some leaders who simply put are out there planning very bad things. And I think that does fit the category of some of these al-Qaeda leaders.
And Petraeus has to keep this balance. I mean, that seems to me the challenge. How much of this is a fight between techno hotshots at Langley with the CIA or inside the Pentagon who are dying to put a drone up every time they get some intelligence versus a Petraeus who wants much more boots on the ground, classic counterinsurgency?
That's the other problem with these technologies, is because they allow you to do things from afar, you get a lot more hands wanting to control the wheel. And one of the things we found is that they're very seductive. One person said it's like crack for generals, and that they can now take over part of the combat operation, even though they may be sitting thousands of miles away. The same for politicians. There's nothing inherently military about being able to order that Predator drone strike. Now, so the question now
so
is
wait, wait a minute,
you
wait a minute.
Do it.
Look, can I interrupt you there? Please, excuse me, because we got to go, but this seems so crucial. Talk about the chain of command. Can some general sitting inside the Pentagon order an airstrike without calling Petraeus at CENTCOM?
They should not. Under the rules, they should not. But the real issue here is that, again, it's not a question of could, it's a question of should. And one of the aspects of this, I remember one of the people in the book saying this, is that you also have the civilian side. We have the potential of taking LBJ down to the foxhole.
Wow. That, I've got to get my head around that. It's not a question of could, it's a question of should. Boy, you don't want to be General Petraeus with those kinds of hot shots all over the world, able to pop drones up and complicate your efforts on the ground. P.W. Singer, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
P.W. Singer is the author of the new book, Wired for War, The Robotics Revolution and Conflict in the 21st Century. He is also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, where he serves as the director of the 21st Century Defense Initiative. Woo.
You're not here to kill me. Figure that part out for myself.
I'm relieved about that. We've got our minds on Detroit today after President Obama announced a short leash for General Motors and Chrysler. Maybe we need some new slogans to make American cars popular again. Give us your new slogan for the new, perhaps nationalized, in need of some self-esteem auto industry.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Goldsberry. I'm calling from Rochester Hills, Michigan, 20 miles north of Detroit. And my slogan is, buy American because your job depends on it, too.
There. That's some self-esteem for you. Tell us your slogan. It's 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Why should we save Detroit? Here's your takeaway.
The smartest people in the car business are not in Japan. They're not in Munich. They're in Detroit.
Who is that talking? Is that Rick Wagner? Can you guess? Can you guess who that is? It's Dan Neal, automotive critic for the Los Angeles Times. If you missed that interview with Dan or anything else, you can take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. I don't know what's wrong with me. I'm kind of freaking out here.
Get a grip, John.
I'm trying. I'm trying, but I got 24 seconds and I have nothing to say. What am I supposed to do?
Get a grip, John.
All right. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. We can move on.
Get a grip, John.
Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.